Brilliant question, Peter. And for that you shall live another day. 2 days, in fact. I feel generous. Rabban's expression remained blank. He still hadn't caught on. Finally, he began to snigger. What should we do, Uncle? The Baron's voice became sickly sweet. Why, we must do everything possible to make sure that your new little brother is raised properly. Naturally, knowing the consistently bad decisions your father has made, we cannot in good conscience allow Abelard Rabban to corrupt this boy. He looked over at the Mentat. Therefore, we must raise him ourselves. I shall prepare the documents immediately, my Lord Baron, de Vries said with a smile. The Baron shouted for Kriubi to attend them, then turned to his nephew. Take all the men you need, Rabban, and don't be too secretive about it. Abelard must understand full well what he has brought upon himself. No one has yet determined the power of the human species, what it may perform by instinct, and what it may accomplish with rational determination. Mentat Objective Analysis of Human Capabilities. Guided by Dominic Vernius, the lighter slipped under the Ixion detection grid, masked by clouds. He cruised low across the pristine surface of his lost homeworld, drinking in the sight of the mountains and waterfalls, the dark pine forests clinging to granite slopes. As the former Lord of Ix, Dominic knew a thousand ways to get inside. He hoped at least one of them still worked. Fighting back tears of dread, he flew onward, intent on his destination. The Imperium knew Ix for its industry and technology, for the marvelous products it exported through Chome distributors. Long ago, House Vernius had chosen to leave the surface unspoiled, burying unsightly production facilities deep underground, which greatly enhanced security and protected valuable Ixion secrets. Dominic remembered the defensive systems he himself had designed and established, as well as those put in place generations before. The threat of technological espionage from rivals such as Richies had always been sufficient for the Ixions to keep up their guard. Surely the Tleilaxu usurpers had instituted their own safeguards, but they would not have found all of Dominic's personal tricks. He had hidden them too well. An organized assault team might be doomed to failure, but Earl Vernius was confident that by himself he could still get back inside his own world. He had to see it with his own eyes. Although each of the hidden openings into the subterranean realms made for weak spots in overall security, Dominic had understood the need for emergency exits and secret routes known only to himself and his family. Deep within the crustal city of Vernii, his beloved capital city, there had been numerous shielded chambers, hidden tunnels, and escape hatches. Dominic's children, along with young Leto Atreides, had used those bolt holes during the bloody overthrow. Now Dominic would use one of the many long-hidden back doors to slip in. He flew the lighter over a series of poorly concealed ventilation shafts, from which steam emerged like thermal geysers. Elsewhere, out on the flat plains, large shafts and cargo platforms opened to allow shipments of materials, mostly outbound. In this deep, forested canyon, narrow, guarded ledges and hollows allowed occasional ships to land. Dominic scanned the terrain as he cruised along until he spotted the subtle markings, the fallen trees, the stains on rugged rock walls. The first disguised entry door was sealed up, the tunnel filled with what must have been meters of solid plascrete. The second door was booby-trapped, but Dominic spotted the explosive connections before he entered his passcode. He didn't try to disarm the device. He flew off again. Dominic dreaded what he might find below in his once beautiful city. In addition to the horrifying message passed along from the Ixian patriot Kater Pilru, his own bribed investigators had brought rumors about conditions on Ix. Yet he had to know what the Tleilaxu and the damned Corinos had done to his cherished planet. Then they would all pay. Next, Dominic landed the lighter in a small hollow surrounded by dark firs. Hoping he remained within the surveillance grid, he stepped out and stood still, smelling the cold, clear air, the spicy pungency of copper pine needles, the wet sharpness of rushing water. In the grottos beneath him, under a kilometer of rock, the air would be warm and thick, redolent of chemicals and a crowded populace. He could almost hear and feel familiar sounds, a faint buzz of activity, a barely discernible vibration under his feet. He located the brush-covered hatch opening of the escape shaft and operated the controls after careful inspection for further traps and explosives. If the Tleilaxu had found this one, then they had been thorough indeed. But he found no sign. Then he waited, hoping the systems still functioned. At last, after the brisk wind had raised goosebumps on his flesh, a self-guided lift chamber rose up, ready to take him deep into the network of caves to a secret personal storeroom at the rear of what had once been the Grand Palais. It was one of several rooms that he had set up in his younger days for contingencies. That had been before the Akazi revolt, before he had married, long before the Tleilaxu takeover. It was safe. Whispering Shando's name, Dominic closed his eyes. The chamber descended at frightening speed, and now he hoped that Kater's sabotage efforts hadn't damaged these hidden systems. He took deep breaths, summoning images from his past on the projection screen of his eyelids. He longed to return to the magical underground city, but feared the harsh reality that awaited him. When the lift chamber came to a stop, Dominic emerged holding a compact laser gun. He also had a flechette pistol in a shoulder holster. The dark storeroom smelled of dust and the mildew of inactivity. No one had been there for a long time. He moved about carefully, went to the hidden locker where he'd stored a pair of nondescript coveralls worn by mid-level workers. Hoping that Tleilaxu had not made drastic changes in work uniforms, he dressed and slipped the laser gun into a custom-fitted holster strapped to his skin, beneath the clothing. Disguised and hoping for the best, knowing he could not turn back, Dominic crept through the dim corridors and located a plaz-walled observation deck. After 2 decades, he took his first look at the reshaped city beneath the ground. He blinked in disbelief. The magnificent Grand Palais had been stripped, all the glittering marble taken away, one entire wing destroyed in an explosion. The immense building now looked like a warehouse with injured shadows of greatness, now an ugly warren of bureaucratic offices. Through panes of window plaz, he saw disgusting Tleilaxu going about their business like cockroaches. Across the projected sky, he watched oblong devices studded with blinking lights cruising in random paths, studying all movement. Surveillance pods. Military equipment designed by Ixians to be sent into battle zones. Now the Tleilaxu used that same technology to spy on his people, to keep them cowering in fear. Sickened, Dominic moved to other observation decks in the grotto ceiling, slipping in and out of groups of people. He stared at their haunted eyes and gaunt faces, trying to remind himself that these were his people, rather than images from a nightmare. He wanted to talk to them, to reassure them that he would do something, and soon. But he could not reveal his identity. He did not know enough about what had occurred there since he and his family had gone renegade. These loyal Ixians had depended on Dominic Vernius, their rightful earl, but he had failed them. He had fled, leaving all of them to their own fates. A feeling of unbearable guilt overwhelmed him. His stomach knotted. With cold calculation, Dominic stared across the cavernous city, looking for the best observation points, pinpointing heavily guarded industrial facilities. Some were shut down and abandoned, others surrounded by buzzing security fields. On the grotto floor, Suboids and Ixian inhabitants worked together like downtrodden slaves. Lights flared on the balconies of the freakishly altered Grand Palais. Public address speakers boomed out, the words reverberating and synchronized so that echoes rippled like force waves up and down the grotto. "People of Shuta," said an accented voice in Gaelic, "we continue to find parasites in our midst. We will do what we must to obliterate this cancer of conspirators and traitors. We, Bene Tlelax, have generously provided for your needs and granted you a part in our holy mission. Therefore, we will punish those who would distract you from your sacred tasks. You must understand and accept your new place in the universe." Down on the grotto floor, Dominic could see squads of soldiers rounding up work gangs. The troops wore the distinctive gray and black uniforms of Sardaukar and carried deadly imperial weapons. So Shaddam no longer even tried to hide his involvement. Dominic seethed. On a Grand Palais balcony, a pair of terrified prisoners flanked by Sardaukar were nudged forward by robed Tlelaxu masters. The speaker boomed again. "These two were captured in the act of committing sabotage against essential industries. During interrogation, they identified other conspirators." An ominous pause followed. "You may anticipate further executions within the week." Only a few isolated voices in the throng dared to cry out in protest. High above, Sardaukar guards pushed the thrashing prisoners to the brink of the balcony. "Death to those who oppose us!" The guards, Imperial guards, shoved them over the edge, and the crowd scattered below. The victims fell across the gulf of empty air, with hideous shrieks that ended abruptly. In horrified fury, Dominic stared. Many times he had stood on that balcony to deliver orations. He had addressed his subjects from there, praising them for their work, promising greater rewards for productivity. The balcony of the Grand Palais should have been a place for the people to see the kindness of their leaders, not an execution platform. Below, shots rang out, and the sizzle of lasgun fire. The Sardaukar clamped down, enforcing order among the angry and restless populace. The voice from the speakers crackled out a final punishment. "For the next 3 weeks, rations will be reduced by 20%. Productivity will remain the same, or further restrictions will be imposed. If volunteers come forward to identify additional conspirators, our rewards will be generous." With a swish of robes, the smug Tlelaxu masters turned about and followed the Sardaukar guards back into the desecrated palais structure. Outraged, Dominic wanted to charge into the city and open fire on the Sardaukar and the Tlelaxu. But alone, a surreptitious spy, he didn't have the firepower to accomplish more than a token attack, and he dared not expose his identity in such a futile gesture. His jaw ached as he ground his teeth together. Gripping the railing, he realized that he had stood on this very observation platform, long ago, with his new bride, Lady Shando. Holding hands, they had gazed across the immense cavern at the fairyland structures of Verniae. She had been bright-eyed, wearing elegant clothes from the imperial court at Kaitain. But the emperor had never forgotten the insult of her departure from his concubine service. Elrood had waited many years for his chance at revenge, and all of Ix had paid for it. Dominic's chest clenched. He'd had it all. Wealth, power, a prosperous world, a perfect wife, a fine family. Now the Cavern City was severely wounded, with barely a hint remaining of its former splendor. "Oh, look what they've done, Shando," he whispered in a morose voice, as if he were a ghost along with her. "Look what they've done." He remained in the city of Verniae for as long as he dared, letting the wheels of reprisal turn in his mind. By the time he made ready to depart, Dominic Vernius knew exactly what he would do to strike back. History would never forget his vengeance. Power and deceit are tools of statecraft, yes. But remember that power deludes the ones who wield it, making them believe it can overcome the defects of their ignorance. Count Flambert Mutelli, early speech in Landsrad Hall of Oratory. Once again, Abelard enjoyed the peaceful nights on Lankeville. He had no regrets about renouncing his powerful family connections. He was content. Roaring fires in the hearths of the great rooms warmed the restored and redecorated main lodge in Tula Fjord. Lounging in the common area adjacent to the big kitchen, he and Emmy felt satisfied, their stomachs full from a large feast of grupper paella they had shared with the servants to celebrate being together again. Most of the original staff had been located and brought back. Finally, Abelard looked forward to the future. That very morning, two Beyondex whales had been seen at the mouth of the fjord, testing the waters. Fishermen reported that recent catches were the best in over a year. The normally dismal weather had turned sharply cold and dusted the cliffs with a clean blanket of snow. Even under the cloudy night skies, the whiteness added a pearly overtone to the shadows. Baby, Fade Rautha, sat on a hand-woven carpet beside Emmy. Good-natured, the boy was prone to giggles and a variety of facial expressions. Clinging to one of his mother's fingers as she held him upright, Fade began to take his first wobbly steps, testing his balance. The bright child already had a small vocabulary, which he employed often. In celebration, Abelard considered bringing out a few old instruments and calling for folk music. But before he could do so, he heard a grating noise outside, the hum of engines. "Are those boats?" When the servants fell silent, he could indeed make out the sounds of aquatic motors. The fish mistress, who was also their cook, had brought a large basin into the sitting room adjacent to the common area, where she used a flat knife to pry open stone clams and chuck the meat into a pot of salted broth. Hearing the commotion outside, she wiped her hands on a towel and looked over her shoulder through the window plaz. "Lights! Boats coming up the fjord! Moving too fast, if you ask me. Dark outside. They could hit something." "Turn up the house glow globes," Abelard commanded. "We need to welcome our visitors." Outside, a wreath of illumination blazed around the wooden structure, shedding a warm glow onto the docks. Three sea craft roared along the rocky waterline, arrowing straight for the main lodge. Emmy clutched Baby Fade. Her wide, normally calm face carried a ripple of uneasiness, and she looked at her husband for reassurance. Abelard made a soft gesture to quell her fears, though he felt a knot forming in his own stomach. He opened the big wooden doors just as the armored boats lashed up against the docks. Uniformed Harkonnen soldiers disembarked onto the quay, their heavy boot steps like cannon fire. Abelard took a step backward as the troops marched up the steep stairs toward him, weapons shouldered but ready for use. Abelard sensed that all of his peace was about to end. Glossu Raban strode onto the dockboards. With brisk, stomping footsteps, He followed the vanguard of armed men.
Emmy, it's him.
Abelard couldn't utter his son's name. More than 4 decades separated Glossu Rabanne from his young sibling, in whom the parents now placed all their hopes. The baby seemed incredibly vulnerable. Abelard's household had no defenses. On impulse, reacting foolishly, Abelard swung shut the heavy door and barred it, which only served to provoke the oncoming soldiers. They opened fire and blasted the century-old barricade. Abelard scrambled back to protect his wife and child. The aged wood smoked and splintered, falling to one side with a dreadful sound like a headsman's axe.
"Is this how you welcome me, father?"
Rabanne gave a gruff laugh as he stepped through the smoke and over the wreckage. The servants began to move about in a flurry. Behind the basin of salted broth, the fish mistress held her little shellfish knife as a pathetic weapon. 2 manservants emerged from the back rooms with spears and fishing knives, but Abelard raised his hands to keep them calm. The Harkonnen soldiers would slaughter them all, just like at Bifrost Eerie, if he didn't handle this properly.
"Is this how you ask for a welcome, son?"
Abelard gestured to the wreckage of the door. "With armed soldiers and military boats arriving in the middle of the night?
My uncle has been teaching me how to make an entrance."
The men in blue Harkonnen livery stood motionless, weapons in plain view. Abelard didn't know what to do. He looked at his wife, but she sat by the roaring fire, clutching the baby close. By the hunted look in her eyes, Abelard knew she was wishing she'd hidden the child somewhere in the main lodge.
"Is that my new little brother, Fade Rautha?" "A prissy-sounding name."
Rabanne shrugged.
"But if he's my own flesh and blood, I suppose I have to love him."
Holding the child even tighter, Emmy tossed her straight hair behind her shoulders, hair that was still black despite her advancing years. She met Rabanne's gaze with hard eyes, angry at what she saw, and torn by a few scraps of love for her own son, whom she could not abandon.
"Let us hope that blood is all you two share. You did not learn to be cruel in this house, Glossu. Not from me, and not from your father. We always loved you, even after you caused us so much pain."
Surprisingly, she stood and took a step toward him, and Rabanne flushed with flustered anger as he inadvertently took a step back.
"How could you have turned out the way you have?"
He glowered at her. Emmy lowered her voice, as if she were asking herself the question, not him.
"We are so disappointed in you. Where did we go wrong? I don't understand it."
Her wide, plain face softened with love and pity, but hardened again as Rabanne burst out in cruel laughter to cover his own unease.
"Oh, I'm disappointed in you too as well. My own parents, and you didn't even invite me to the naming ceremony of my little brother."
He stepped forward.
"Let me hold the brat."
Emmy drew back, protecting her good son from the bad. Rabanne feigned a look of sadness, then strode closer. The Harkonnen troops raised their weapons and advanced.
"Leave your mother alone," Abelard said.
One of the soldiers put up a single hand and stopped him from rushing forward. Rabanne turned to him.
"I can't sit idly by and let my own brother be corrupted by an embarrassing weakling like you, father. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, your half-brother and head of our great house, has already filed documents and received full Landsrat approval to raise Fade Rautha in his own household on Gedi Prime."
One of the guards took out an ornate scroll of imprinted Sarti parchment and tossed it on the floor at Abelard's feet. Abelard could only stare at it.
"He has adopted the boy formally and legally as his foster son."
Smiling at his parents' horrified expressions, Rabanne said,
"In the same manner that he has already adopted me. I am his heir designate, the Na Baron. I'm a Harkonnen as pure and proper as the Baron himself.
He extended his thick arms. The troops kept their weapons steady, but Emmy backed closer to the fire.
See, you have nothing to worry about.
Jerking his head to one side, Raban signaled two of the nearest men, who opened fire on the fish mistress where she stood, still holding the little curved knife. During Raban's brief stay in the main lodge, the husky woman had cooked many meals for him. But now the lasgun beams cut her down before she could even scream. The fish mistress dropped her knife and tumbled forward into the basin. Clams turned over, and sour-smelling water spilled onto the wooden floor.
"How many more of them will you force me to kill, Mother?" he inquired, almost plaintively, still reaching out with his thick-fingered hands. "You know I'll do it. Now give me my brother."
Emmy's gaze flicked from Raban's to all of the terrified household servants, to the baby boy, and then to Abelard, who did not have the courage to meet her eyes. He could only make a strangled cry in his throat. Though she gave him no sign of surrender, Raban pulled the infant roughly from her numb arms, and she did not resist. Out of fear that all the other people in the house would be slaughtered, just the way the Harkonnen troops had slaughtered the innocent workers at Bifrost Eyrie. Unable to bear the thought of her baby being taken away, Emmy gave a small gasp, as if the anchors that had always given her strength and stability had just been severed. The child began to cry upon seeing the broad, stony face of his much older brother.
"You can't do this," Abelard said, still unwilling to push his way past the armed guards. "I am planetary governor here. I will contest this with the Landsrad."
"You have no legal rights whatsoever. We didn't contest your meaningless title as planetary governor. But when you renounced your Harkonnen name, you forfeited your position all nice and tidy."
Raban held the struggling baby at arm's length, as if he didn't know what to do with a child. The parchment legal document still lay untouched on the floor.
"You are effectively nothing, Father. Nothing at all."
Taking the boy, he headed back toward the smoking ruins of the door. Abelard and Emmy, both wild with grief, screamed after him, but the guards turned around, pointing their weapons.
"Oh, don't kill anyone else," Raban said to them. "I'd rather hear a house full of whimpering as we leave."
The soldiers marched down the steps to the docks, where they boarded the armored boats. Abelard held Emmy tightly, rocking her back and forth, and they supported each other like two trees fallen together. Both of their faces were streaked with tears, their eyes wide and glassy. The servants in the house wailed in anguish. Raban's military boats cruised off across the black waters of Tula Fjord. Abelard gasped, unable to breathe. Emmy shuddered in his arms, and he tried to comfort her. But he felt utterly helpless, ineffective, and crushed. She stared at her open, calloused hands, as if expecting to see her baby there. Off in the distance, though he knew it was only his imagination, Abelard thought he could hear the child crying even over the roar of the departing boats. Never be in the company of anyone with whom you would not want to die, Freeman saying. When Leetkynes returned from Seleucia Secundus to the smuggler base at Dune's South Pole, he found his friend Warwick awaiting him.
"Look at you," the taller Freeman said with a laugh.
Warwick threw back his hood as he rushed across the crunching gravel at the bottom of the hidden chasm. He embraced Leet and pounded him sharply on the back.
"You're water-fat and clean,"
he sniffed deprecatingly. "I see no mark of the stillsuit upon you. Have you washed all the desert from yourself?"
"I'll never get the desert out of my blood," Leet clasped his friend. "And you? You've grown."
"The happiness of married life, my friend. Farula and I have a son now, named Leet Chi, in your honor."
He smacked a fist into his palm. And I've continued to fight the Harkonnens every day, while you've grown pampered and soft among these outsiders.
A son.
Leet felt a twinge of sadness for himself, but it passed, replaced by genuine joy for his friend and gratitude for the honor of the name. The smugglers unloaded their cargo with little conversation or banter. They were uneasy and sullen because Dominic Vernius had not accompanied them back to Arrakis. Jodam and Asuyo shouted orders for stowing the material they had brought from Seleucia Secundus. Gurney Halleck had remained behind on Seleucia to supervise the smuggler operations there. Warwick had been at the Antarctic base for 5 days now, eating the smugglers' food, telling the men how to survive the deserts of Dune.
"I don't think they'll ever learn, Leet," he whispered with a snort.
"No matter how long they live here, they'll still be off-worlders." As they strode back into the main tunnels, Warwick shared his news. 2 times in a row, he had taken the spice bribe down to Rondo Tuic, trying to find out when his friend would return. It had seemed a long time.
"Whatever drove you to go to a place like Seleucia Secundus?"
"A journey I had to take," Leet responded. "My father grew up there, and spoke of it so often. But I'm back now, and I intend to stay. Dune is my home. Seleucia was just an interesting diversion."
Pausing, Warwick scratched his long hair. It was matted and kinked from many hours under a still-suit hood. No doubt Ferula kept his water rings for him, as a wife should do.
Leet wondered what the elfin young woman looked like now.
"So, will you return to Redwall Siege, Leet, where you belong?
Ferula and I miss you. It makes us sad that you feel the need to stay apart from us."
With a hard swallow, Leet admitted, "I was foolish. I wanted time alone to consider my future. So many things have changed, and I have learned so much."
He forced a smile.
"I think I comprehend my father better now."
Warwick's blue within blue eyes widened.
"Who would question the Yomakines? We simply do his bidding."
"Yes, but he's my father, and I wanted to understand him." From a high vantage inside the frozen walls, they gazed across the layered terraces of the dust-impregnated ice cap.
"Whenever you're ready, my friend, we can summon a worm and return to the siege."
Warwick pursed his lips to squelch an expression of mirth.
"If you remember how to put on your still suit."
Leet snorted and went to his locker, where he had stored the desert equipment.
"You may have beaten me in our race to the Cave of Birds," he shot a sidelong glance at his taller friend, "but I can still call a larger worm."
They bade farewell to the other smugglers. Although the hardened old men had been Leet's companions for almost a year, he did not feel close to them. They were military, loyal to their commander and accustomed to regimented training. They talked endlessly of bygone days and battles on far-off worlds, of leading charges beside Earl Vernius for the glory of the Imperium. But their passions had soured, and now they simply did what they could to annoy Shaddam. Leet and Warwick trekked across the Antarctic wasteland, avoiding the dirt and grit of the water merchants' industries. Warwick looked back at the cold, unmarked terrain.
"I see you've taught them a few things, even beyond what we showed them the first time. Their stronghold is not quite so obvious as before."
"You noticed, eh?" Leet said, pleased.
"With a good Freeman teacher, even they can learn the obvious."
Reaching the desert boundary at last, they planted their thumper and summoned a worm. Soon they headed due north into the wild flatlands where dust and storms and capricious weather patterns had always discouraged Harkonnen patrols. As their mount plowed through the sands, taking them toward the equatorial regions, Warwick spoke at great length. He seemed happier and more filled with stories and good-natured anecdotes than ever before. Still feeling a dull pain in his heart,
Leet listened to his friend talk about Ferula and their son, their life together, a trip they had taken to Siege Tabor, a day spent in Arakeen, how one day they wanted to go to the greenhouse demonstration project in Plaster Basin. All the while, Leet found himself daydreaming. If only he'd called a larger worm, or driven it harder, or rested less, he might have arrived first. Both young men had made the same wish upon the Beyan, the uncovered white lake bed, so long ago, to marry the same girl, and only Warwick's wish had been granted. It was the will of Shai-Hulud, as Freeman would say. Leet had to accept it. At night they made camp, then sat on a dune crest, where they tossed tally sticks into the sand. Afterward, watching the stars glide silently overhead in the darkness, they sealed themselves inside the still tent. With the soft feel of the desert beneath him, Leet Kynes slept better than he had in months. They traveled hard and fast. 2 days later, Leet found himself longing to see Redwall Siege again, to greet his mother Freeth, to tell his father what he had seen and done on Seleucia Secundus. But that afternoon, Leet stared across the sands at a brownish-tan smudge on the horizon. He removed his stillsuit plugs and inhaled deeply, smelling ozone, and his skin tingled with static electricity in the air. Warwick frowned. "It's a big storm, Leet, approaching rapidly." He shrugged with forced optimism. "Perhaps it will just be a Hainali wind. We can brave it." Leet kept his thoughts to himself, not wishing to give voice to unpleasant suspicions. Evil possibilities spoken aloud could attract the evil itself. But as the knot of weather grew closer and louder, rising ominously tall and brown in the sky, Leet stated the obvious. "No, my friend, it is a Coriolis storm." Grimly he clamped his mouth shut. He remembered his experience years before in the meteorological pod with his father, and more recently in the aurora storm on Seleucia Secundus. But this was worse, much worse. Warwick looked over at him and gripped a ridge on the worm's back. "Ulasikaliwala, the wind of the demon in the open desert." Leet studied the oncoming cloud. At the highest levels, the murk was caused by tiny dust particles blown to great altitudes, whereas closer to the ground, the winds would pick up the heavier, scouring sand. "Ulasikaliwala," he thought. This was the Freeman term for the most powerful of all Coriolis storms, the wind that eats flesh. Beneath them, the sandworm became agitated and restless, reluctant to continue. As the deadly storm approached, the creature would dive to safety underground, no matter how many spreaders and maker hooks they applied to open its body segments. Leet scanned the wind-fuzzed dunes that spread like an endless ocean in all directions. Open, unbroken desert. No mountains. No shelter. Warwick didn't answer, continuing to search for the slightest irregularity across the spreading paleness. "There!" He stood atop the worm's back and pointed with one outstretched finger. "A small outcropping. Our only chance." Leet squinted. Already the wind slapped irritating dust in his face. He saw only a tiny fleck of brownish-black, a knob of rock like a misplaced boulder jutting out of the sands. "Doesn't look like much." "It is all we have, my friend." Warwick thrashed with his goad sticks to turn the worm toward the tiny embankment before the Coriolis storm hit. A flurry of high-velocity grit whipped their faces, scratched at their eyes. They kept their stillsuit plugs firmly pressed into their nostrils and their mouths clamped tight, then pulled hoods forward to cover their faces. But Leet still felt as if the grit penetrated the pores of his skin. The hoarse wind whispered in his ears and then grew louder, like the breath of a dragon,
The increasing electrical fields nauseated him, gave him a pounding headache, which would only decrease if he grounded himself well on the sand. An impossibility out here. As they approached the tiny cluster of rocks, Leet's heart sank. He could see it now, a mere elbow of hardened lava exposed by scouring winds, barely the size of a still tent with rough edges, cracks, and crannies. Certainly not large enough to shelter both of them. "Warwick, this will not work. We must find another way." His companion turned to him. "There is no other way." The sandworm reared and thrashed, resisting the direction Warwick wanted it to take. As they approached their unlikely sanctuary, the storm rose above them as a great brown wall in the sky. Warwick released his hooks. "Now, Leet, we must trust to our boots, our skills, and to Shai-Hulud." Letting go of the ropes, Leet plucked his maker hooks free and leaped. The worm dove into the sand, tunneling with a vengeance. Leet scrambled off its rough back, jumping away from the wake of soft sand. The Coriolis storm rushed toward them with a dry swishing sound, scouring the ground and howling like an angry creature. Leet could no longer differentiate between desert and sky. Fighting against the wind, they scrambled onto the rock. Only one crevice was deep enough for a man to huddle inside, pull down his cloak, and hope to be shielded from the ravenous, blasting sand. Warwick looked at it, then faced the oncoming storm. He raised his head high. "You must take the shelter, my friend. It is yours." Leet refused. "Impossible. You're my blood brother. You have a wife and child. You must go back to them." Warwick gazed at him with a cold but distant glare. "And you are the son of Umakines. Your life is worth more than mine. Take the shelter before the storm kills us both." "I won't let you sacrifice your life for me." "I won't give you the choice." Warwick turned to step off the rock, but Leet grabbed his arm and yanked him back.
"No!
How do freemen choose in situations like this? How do we decide the best way to preserve water for our tribe? I say your life is worth more because you have a family. You say I'm worth more just because of who my father is. We cannot resolve this in time."
"Then God must choose," Warwick said.
"All right, then." Leet snatched a tally stick from the sash at his side. "And you must abide by the decision." When Warwick frowned, Leet swallowed hard as he added, "And so must I." They both removed their sticks, turned to the soft dune, shielding the angle of their throw from the blasting wind. The storm beast came closer and louder, a roiling universe of eternal darkness. Warwick threw first, the pointed end of his bone dart embedding itself into the soft surface. 7. As Leet threw his own bone stick, he thought, if he won, his friend would die. And if he lost, he himself would die. But he could think of no other way. Warwick strode out to kneel where the sticks had landed.